multifamily is stronger than ever. And the big thing is opportunity. And you've seen this slide many times on our past previous webinars. We think the opportunity is here today. We are doubling down on the fact and the sentiment we think is a generational buying opportunity.
Welcome to Investing in the US, a podcast for real estate investors, business owners, and aspiring entrepreneurs looking to grow their wealth by investing in US real estate. I'm your host, Reid Goossens, and so far, I've acquired over $800 million worth of investments on various properties across the United States. On this podcast, I interview go-getters, risk-takers, and the best in the business to learn more about their investment journey and the cutting-edge strategies they are applying towards building a legacy. For more on growing your own wealth and by investing in the US, visit www.reidgoossens.com.
Hello, everyone. I want to thank you all for joining us to a biannual State of the Market. And we're going to recap 2024. We are genuinely live on today's webinar. So we're going to go through the meat and potatoes of our presentation. Then we're going to have a Q&A at the end. And this is going to be unscripted. There's no pre-canned questions. So please apologize in advance if we stumble on our words or hear any background noise. But Ben, before we get into it, do you want to say a quick hello to everyone?
Yeah, look, great to be here, guys. We love doing these presentations. They take a tremendous amount of work to put our thoughts on paper, but we're excited to share them with you.
The reason we do these, and this is a big welcome for our first installment of 2025, and the purpose of this webinar is really us as a company to share our thoughts on the past and the present and look at what the multifamily has for install for 2025 here in the US, along with how we are responding to the many challenges, but also the inordinate amount of opportunities that lie ahead. So with that being said, let's get into it. We're going to do a quick brief background on who we are as a company. For those of you who have never joined and are new, RSN Property Group has been in existence for 10 years. We've done about 25 syndications as lead sponsors, about 4,600 units, and a bit shy of $900 million of total portfolio acquisitions. We are in, I think, six MSAs now, San Antonio, Central Texas, Austin. We're about to get into Dallas, Phoenix, Atlanta, Gainesville, Greenville, South Carolina, and we're about to break into Orlando, Florida as well. We focus on primarily value-add multifamily in the workforce housing space.
So we're going to talk about the past first, then we'll jump into the present and the future. And this will be a bit of a recap of our many last webinars, and then we'll look at the last 6 months. And look, over our last few webinars, we certainly covered a lot of ground. So I'm going to move through this very quickly. If you want to look back on the old webinars, they're all on YouTube. But one of the key themes that we've been bringing up again and again since we started doing these webinars in 2022 is that it's going to be a bumpy ride for investors. And it certainly has been. The last 3 years have probably been the worst for the multifamily industry and the wider commercial real estate industry since the 2008 crash. And we're not out of the woods yet, but downswings happen in every market and they're always followed by recoveries with big opportunities. So let's talk about it. We've got the recap slide here, and we were on the tail end of a record-breaking period of growth. In fact, it was the longest period of growth in US history, which covered from 2009 to 2020. And you can see in the top left-hand corner of the chart showing the white sections are growth and the gray sections are recessions. And you see the little recession in COVID that hit there. And of course, COVID hit, changed everything, impacted the world in crazy ways. And even putting aside the direct human impact of the virus itself, some of the big changes that we're going to talk about here is that it immediately changed the work dynamic. So remote working accelerated massively. And while people are returning to the office, remote work is here to stay. And this impacted commercial real estate by crushing the office sector. Retail got hit hard too. And from a bigger picture point of view, in response to all of the economic challenges of COVID, the government responded with massive stimulus in the form of loans and grants. And then boom, record inflation hits, as you can see with the chart in the top right there. So the Federal Reserve needed to act, and they responded with record interest rate rises, the fastest and largest interest rate rises in modern history, in fact. And the absolutely booming multifamily sector turns on a dime, and we have the worst 2 to 3 years in the market in modern history. And this graph shows it well. This is a slide of US multifamily valuations and deal volume. And you can see the rent hikes, almost the exact moment they hit, the blue line starts trending down, which is asset prices. And pretty quickly after that, deal volume, falls and completely drops. You can see that with the red circle. Because in 2022, 2023, and 2024, if you weren't forced to sell, you held on. because asset prices are low. It just wasn't a good time to sell. So in order to hold on, operators had to do all sorts of things. They had to do investor capital calls. They had to take on preferred equity, pause distributions, and do all manner of different things to hold and stay in the deal. And of course, do loan modifications with lenders. Even that wasn't enough for a lot of operators. There's been a lot of distress. A lot of operators have lost assets. They've lost their businesses. And investors have taken big haircuts on their investments. And there's still a lot of pent-up distress with operators holding and hoping, as we used to call it. But now in the industry, that's been referred to as extending and pretending. And we're going to talk about that a lot more as we go through the webinar here. And look, this all of this distress started to spill over into the banking sector. And distress got so bad in mid-2023, there were concerns there might even be a 2008-style housing crash impacting commercial real estate that wipes out the regional banking sector and then has threats of a wider contagion. Luckily, that hasn't happened, and it seems increasingly unlikely because, as luck would have it, or as it seems to be, in the last 6 months, things have started to stabilize quite a bit, and the Fed has perhaps managed to accomplish a rarely achieved feat of a soft landing. And we'll be the first to say we're a bit skeptical of that sort of unfolding. But let's talk about the last 6 months here. So the election cycle is over and a lot of uncertainty has been taken out of the markets. And love them or hate them, Trump's policies are likely net positive for the multifamily market. There's going to be good and bad, and we're going to talk about that later. And of course, with inflation largely tamed, as you can see here in the top left-hand graph, sitting with inflation sitting just above 2%, just above the Fed's 2% target. You know, the Fed started a rate cutting cycle with the Fed funds interest rate dropping from 5.25% to 4.25%. And home prices are higher than ever. Stocks are higher than ever. And economic optimism has seen a huge uptick as well. So it looks like the Fed achieved a soft landing. We were very pessimistic about this and preparing for a hard landing. We're still structuring all of our investment and business interests relatively defensively, but it does appear right now we're past the worst of it. And in fact, this is very likely the optimal time to enter the multifamily real estate market. And with that little recap, I'm going to pass over to Reid to talk about the present.
Thanks, Ben. So as Ben just mentioned, multifamily housing prices have hit rock bottom probably in early 2024, based on our calculations and, you know, according to this graph, when slowly starting to see an uptick. But we've also seen a swath of multifamily properties that are priced well below replacement costs. And if you look at that graph, some of the pricing of multifamily today is somewhere between 20, 30, maybe even 40% below the peak. Now, the peak may be an anomaly, but it's still below where things were trading for in 2021 and 2022. We are starting to see a lot of operators in distress, finally reaching the end of their ability to hold on, or as Ben said, end of their ability to just extend and pretend. And that's inversely meaning there's being a big uptick in deal flow compared to where we've had. It's been pretty barren for the last 2 to 3 years. Now, many of these deals that are distressed are due to one thing, and that's bad debt, right? Floating rates or loan maturities. Now, some are held by inexperienced operators who jumped into the multifamily market, you know, near the peak, thinking it was easy money. Others have been actually surprising. There's been some very skilled and experienced operators who also got overextended themselves, and some others were just plain unlucky. So, but the big thing that underlies this thesis is that multifamily is stronger than ever. And these assets may have dipped in value, 20, 30, 40%. But they're made of the same bricks and mortar that they always have were, and people still need a place to live. Housing affordability is at its worst it's ever been. And this is a combination, as you can see. So before I get into this, you can see from this graph, sorry, go back one, Ben, that this housing affordability is at its worst that it has been, even compared to the 2008 global financial crisis. I'm not sure if that's a canary in the coal mine, but we are lower than where we were back in 2006, 2007. Now, this in combination with higher interest rates, mortgage rates are actually at the highest point they have been in 6 months, despite the fact the Fed is starting the rate cutting cycle. And as Ben mentioned, you know, home prices are higher than ever. It simply makes a lot more sense today to be renting than it does to be buying. And the unfortunate truth is that the dream of owning a home is dying or is dead. Affordability has gone past the point of no return, with the average home in the US nearing $500,000. Now, we believe society is and has been gradually adjusting to a renter mindset, much like Europe and other parts of the world, which is going to continue to push up rental yields for those investors in the multifamily space. Currently, and here's a stat for you, 1 in 3 households can afford to purchase the median home price today without spending more than 25% of their income on the mortgage payment. Now, by contrast, in 2021, when mortgage rates were around 3%, probably under half of what they are today, 55% of households met those income requirements. So we've seen a massive, massive change just because of that interest rate peaks. Those interest rates not only hurt multifamily, but it's hurting the ability for people to go out and get homes and get mortgages. Now, the rental pool has currently outpaced home ownership. And for the first time in 20 years, according to the growth of the US rental housing market, that has outpaced that of home ownerships for 4 consecutive quarters, according to Redfin analysis of the US census data. Additionally, the National Association of Realtors, they did a review of the US Bureau of Data, and that reveals between 2021 and 2023, the share of build-to-rent housing, the starts of those new housing, doubled, reaching 10% of all single-family housing starts were for rental purposes. So, and in the third quarter of 2024, new renting households grew at 3 times the rate of new homeowner households. So what does this mean? If we look at this chart, we clearly have a large deficit of housing units here in the United States. And this chart only shows up to 2022. And we've gone and done our further research for this presentation. And the numbers in 2024, we require 1.7 million units per year to be built in order to match demand. But if you look at the overall construction data, today we're only on pace to match 1.3 million units. And we think that with the continued high interest rates combined with a swath of new multifamily deliveries across the Sun Belt in the past 3 years, we think that the deficit will continue to be exactly that, a deficit. And we think it's going to continue to grow now that, we'll talk about housing starts have fallen off a cliff. But we still think demand will outstrip supply for the foreseeable future and potentially get worse. And as I mentioned, we're going to talk about that a lot later in the webinar. But for now, we anticipate rents will continue to trend upwards. And even though we have seen a big decline over the last 2 years due to the increase in housing starts, if you look at the long-term outlook, we expect rents to start to steady and start have rental increases. Now, during the pandemic, we all know that rental growth surged significantly, driven by economic stimulus, with the average rental growth across the United States reaching double digits. This has now eased considerably, and we're returning to what we think is a pre-pandemic levels of 2-3% in most major markets. Now, while some regions have experienced some significant negative rent growth, we believe these fluctuations will actually stabilize in the next 6-18 months, bringing about rental rates back to the 2-3% annual rent growth that we saw in the pre-pandemic levels. Now, if we take a step back, and this is a slide we show on all of our webinars, it's an interesting slide because it's true. One of the biggest fundamentals we have to understand as investors is that if inflation continues to be a problem, anything that's positive inflation, rents will also slowly climb over time. And if we look back at the data, over the past 70 years, overwhelmingly, rent has continued to slowly and steadily tick up. And we don't think that's stopping anytime soon. And the real kicker is that not only is this thesis still strong, there is a lot of distress in terms of operators being forced to sell, as I mentioned earlier. And Ben is going to get into the overall market distress and what we're seeing right now and the massive opportunities that are here and what we've been speaking about for some period of time. And we think they're going to reap extremely favorable outcomes for those investors willing to invest today. So Ben, I'm going to hand it back over to you.
Look, let's talk about that distress. And as we said earlier, these multifamily assets are made of brick and mortar, and the vast majority are physically fine. There's no problem with the buildings. The overwhelming majority of the distress is due to debt. So things like floating rate debt that dramatically jumped due to the rate hikes, mortgages that need to be refinanced or deals that need to be sold, but due to asset price declines, they're underwater. And there's not enough equity left in the deal to, return any investor funds or in many cases, even make the lender whole. This is a slide we showed in one of our previous webinars. It's from 2001, and we're going to show a couple of slides after this that build on this. And we pointed out at the time that there's an upcoming wall of mortgage maturities coming due in 2022, 23, and 24. And what's been happening is that a lot of these mortgages have been extended, kicking the can down the road to a time when market conditions are better. You know, we called it the hold and hope strategy at the time, and the term has become known in the industry now as extend and pretend. So let's look at some charts here. So this chart on the left, if you look at the green line, that is multifamily. And on the right, it's the same chart, but in table format. And you can very clearly see that on the second half of last year, distress really started to pick up significantly. And so the question is, you know, how is this distress being handled in the multifamily sector? And on the left-hand chart here, we can point out that of the distressed loans, a whopping 42% are past their maturity date and the monthly mortgage payments are not being made. But the bank has not yet foreclosed or decide how they're going to handle that situation. Another 17% are past their maturity date, but the monthly payments are being made. So presumably the banks are happy to get paid and not foreclose or take ownership. Now, if we look over to the chart on the right, and we see that the loans that do get modified to put themselves back in good standing, 46% of them have maturity date extensions formally granted, and another 15% have maturity date extensions and another action like forbearance. That's 60% of the loans that are arguably being extended and pretended. So let's take a look at these slides here. On the left, it shows all the commercial mortgages supposed to mature over the next few years, and I'm mainly looking at 2024 here. And the chart on the right is from 2022, and it shows the expectations for the number of mortgages that were going to mature in 2022 in the lighter shade, and then the expectations that became apparent in 2023 in the darker shade. So everyone thought it was going to be 650 million, but then it looks like it's going to be more like 900 billion, sorry, billion with a B. So you know it's a problem when the Federal Reserve themselves start publishing papers using the phrase extend and pretend. And this is not a favorable article. You guys can check this out if you like. And where I'm going with this is, you know, if you take a look at this chart, we very roughly updated it to illustrate what's occurring. Instead of a lot of these maturities happening in 2024 as expected, the can got kicked down the road again to 2025. And now we're looking at over $1 trillion in mortgages maturing in 2025. Great report here that we'll reference highlighting the extend and pretend strategy, seeing 81% rent growth over most of 81% growth over the most of 2024, with foreclosures also ticking up by 80%. Now, if this all sounds a little crazy to you, we tend to agree. You know, you can't kick the can down the road forever. At some point, you know, everyone has to come home to roost, and lenders in the industry are beginning to realize this can't go on forever. Now, God willing, time will save some percentage of these deals. Interest rates will continue to drop, asset prices will climb, and some percentage of these deals will stop being underwater. Lenders will be made whole, equity holders will not be completely wiped out. That said, many won't. And that distress bringing these deals to the market will put stable, well-capitalized operators and cashed-up investors in a very strong position to snap up these bargains and see outsized returns with limited further downside. Now let's talk about the future, because this ties into it. Obviously, interest rates are expected to drop over the coming year and beyond. Now, this is going to depend on jobs and inflation, the Fed's mandate for stability and maximum employment. We had an unexpectedly strong jobs report on January, and the latest inflation data comes out tomorrow. As this is the future section, RSN is going to make some predictions, and we predict that rates will drop, but slower than the Fed indicates in this chart. And we're defensively structuring our deals on the basis that the Fed funds rates stay flat or even go up, while leaving ourselves the opportunity to refinance if rates do drop significantly. So we're always looking at fixed rate debt and you know, other structures that support this thesis. And it's important to understand that while associated with the Fed funds rate, mortgage rates are more correlated to the 10 and 30 year treasury rates, which are largely based on investor sentiment about the future health of the economy, with higher yields often suggesting stronger economic growth and higher inflation. That said, even if the Fed holds steady on rates, we see the current spread between mortgage rates and the Fed fund rate compressing over 2025 and mortgage rates lowering. Now, the other thing to look forward for in the future is the Trump administration. Trump has stated that there's going to be universal tariffs for all goods of 20% and 60% from China. And whether or not that actually gets implemented the way he intends, there's certainly going to be more tariffs, which are inherently inflationary. Now, products and goods like construction materials and raw materials will inherently be more expensive, and it may start to make more sense to buy them from US suppliers. Now, this is almost certainly going to increase the cost of construction and particularly new development of multifamily units, something that Reid will speak to shortly. On the tax policy front, we're likely to see tax policies that are very favorable to business, commercial real estate, and multifamily specifically. For starters, bonus depreciation, currently at 40% and set to phase out over the next 2 years, is likely to come back at 100%. Corporate taxes could be lowered, and generally many of the provisions of the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act could be extended or made permanent. This will almost certainly boost multifamily returns and flow through tax benefits to investors. And on the immigration policy front, Trump has made it clear that he'll tighten up the border and look to deport anyone here illegally. However you feel about this, we see this as actually being a net negative to the commercial real estate industry and multifamily. These policies largely target Latinos, and Latinos have an outsized role in the construction industry. We see deportations and reduced immigration having an upward effect on construction costs. And if we're right again, it's going to be new developments that suffer the most. And then the last one is deregulation and DOGE. You know, Trump plans to eliminate 10 regulations for every one his administration creates. Again, we'll see what happens in reality there. But this includes everything from banking regulations, how much capital banks have to have on their books, to environmental regulations. And then you've got Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy running the Department of Government Efficiency, which, you know, it sort of sounded like a joke to begin with, but they're taking it seriously. And they plan to eliminate $2 trillion from the U.S. annual budget. And I mean, it does sound crazy, but all I'll say is, love him or hate him, every single big business or initiative that Elon Musk takes on gets called crazy, and he has a habit of proving his doubters wrong. He doesn't always succeed, but even if he ends up cutting $1 trillion or $500 billion, that's going to have a very unpredictable impact on society, the economy, and multifamily. It's hard to predict what might happen here, but we're watching this space closely. Now, the other thing we see in the future is a resurgence of non-bank lenders. And this slide could have easily been titled, you know, loosening of credit and loosening of lending standards. And, you know, with falling interest rates and a positive economic outlook, we're definitely seeing small and nimble lenders willing to take on more risk and willing to be more creative. The program on the screen right now is just one of many that we've seen pop up lately. This one in particular offers 90% loan to cost by combining debt and equity in the same structure. And again, we're seeing all sorts of creative programs being offered and a lot more market outreach from these non-bank lenders. And keep in mind, with these distressed deals that are already here and are largely going to ramp up, many of these deals won't qualify for agency debt, or the terms just won't make sense. So we expect to see non-bank lenders playing an outsized role in 2025 compared to prior years. Now, the last part of the future is multifamily supply. And I'm going to take a breath before Q&A and pass it over to Reid to talk about multifamily supply and rent growth.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. So the supply is a key theme here. And you know, a lot of us have seen over the last few years record deliveries of new units, which has muted rent growth, and with higher interest rates has now forced multifamily values to decline. Now, as you know, at the time when interest rates were at record lows near 0% back in 2020, 2023, we saw a glut of new supply hit across the US, particularly in the Sun Belt, which is where a lot of people were moving to in a post-pandemic, you know, work-from-home world. And this massive amount of starts also fueled the big negative rent growth and forced rents to decline across the US, particularly in those Sunbelt regions where we saw a lot of people starting to move to. Now, multifamily housing starts have fallen off a cliff, and we're at a 10-year low. And this is due to the higher interest rates and inflation driving up the cost of construction to points where it just, new deals or new construction just doesn't make any sense to be building in a declining rental market. And this is a common tale that we've seen repeat over history. Low interest rates fuels more construction. We overbuild, then rents decline, then the handbrake is applied and history is repeating itself again. If we look at this next chart, it's a bit of a complicated chart, but you can see that the orange lines are absorption and the blue lines are delivery. So you can see back in after the pandemic, we had a massive amount of absorption as the pandemic hit, because people wanted to not live with, you know, not get COVID. And then we saw vacancies decline. And then we started to see net deliveries outpace absorption. And we saw, you know, here in 2022, 2023, not a lot was being absorbed. The good news is that a lot of the glut of new supply is actually surprisingly being absorbed. And we can see that obviously through the graph here, but this is quite frankly illustrates, you know, just how much demand still remains, coupled with the high inflation that we're still seeing, stagnant wages and higher interest rates. People are being forced to rent for longer, which is, you know, over the long term will be good for multifamily investors. Now, if we look at the rents, now we've been talking a lot about the US as a whole, and what this means. But if we take a closer look at certain markets, you can see that a different story is playing out in real time. Now, on this graph, it shows how each market is doing versus when the peak of their supply in that market will hit. Now, interestingly, we own and operate across many of these markets, and this graph is actually lining up pretty well with what we're seeing with our boots on the ground. If you're an investor in one of our Phoenix deals, we saw a big rental decline in the tail end of 2020, really middle of 2023 and the tail end of 2023 with a massive spike in vacancies. However, since early 2024, all of our assets in that market, 95% occupied, and we're starting to see small amounts of rent growth, indicating that we think we've hit the bottom. And if those little green markers are actually where the peak deliveries are expected to hit. Now, Austin, on the other hand, which is another, is not the same case. And it was one of the darling childs of the post-pandemic migration boom. But Austin has struggled with absorption and is still experiencing significant rental loss and higher vacancies, not only from this graph, but also from, you know, the assets we own down there. Now, the good news is that we believe with the continued, higher interest rates and the lack of new housing starts, because housing starts are...
Hey guys, I just want to take a second to share with you our latest multifamily investment opportunity, Eagle Creek Landing, located in the booming Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. Rapid fire, here are the reasons why we love this asset. Number one, strong investor returns. We are looking at approximately 20% annualized to investors. Number two, over $5 million in property improvements have already been completed by the seller to date. And number three, and here's the biggest kicker, multifamily property prices have dropped further today than they did compared to the 2008 global financial crisis. We are picking this asset up at a massive 50% discount compared to the market peaks only a couple of years ago in 2021 and 2022. Don't miss your chance to get involved in this incredible opportunity. Click on the link below or head to www.rsnpropertygroup.com to find out more.
Just you can't just turn on that spigot or turn on a light and they just start tomorrow. Most of these markets will absorb their supply, we believe, in the next 6 to 12 months. And if it hasn't already happened, like, you know, we've seen in Orlando, or you've seen in Phoenix, or you've seen in, you know, potentially Fort Lauderdale. And this will start to then we return to a stabilized vacancy with positive rental growth, probably in that 2 to 3% rent growth, which was pre-pandemic levels. So with all that being said, how are we moving forward at RSN? Well, the big thing is opportunity. And you've seen this slide many times on our past previous webinars. We think the opportunity is here today, and we're going to show you some examples of those opportunities. But how are we adjusting at RSN? Well, we are doubling down on the fact and the sentiment we think this is a generational buying opportunity. We are trying to work on the distressed acquisitions and really create a niche for ourselves as operators to buy these distressed acquisitions and help these distressed owners out of a prickly situation. So we're having to come up with really creative financing, which we can talk about one deal in a minute. We're also deepening our partnerships with institutional capital. Institutional capital has started to get back in the pool, and that is a good sign that they also think that we're at the bottom or at a really opportune time to be buying. We are seeing a lot more distressed assets that won't necessarily qualify for agency debt. Now, the last four deals we've done, or five deals we've done in the last 2 years, have only been agency debt. But with the more distress that we're seeing, we can only strategically use bridge debt that makes sense whilst we're fixing those rates when we're having to use bridge debt. But bridge debt is now starting to become a player again in these distress situations where we're negotiating directly with the bank. And the last thing we're doing is we're obviously actively leveraging AI. You know, we've been involved in the multifamily space for over a decade. AI is in the last 5 years since the pandemic has really, really started to ramp up in the real estate, particularly commercial real estate. And I think it's obviously here to stay, but across our organization, it's completely changing the way we do business, everything from investor relations to acquisitions to attracting tenants and, you know, reducing delinquency. And I think that's going to have a profound effect on the overall opportunity that lies ahead for us as we see some of these distress opportunities hit the market. Yeah, we do actually have three active listings right now. Some of you, if you're joined part of our newsletter, you would have seen the villas at Princeton Lake. If any of you are interested in any of these deals, please reach out to us. The villas at Princeton Lake closed in November last year, and we actually have a few limited spots left. And we're going to have two deals hitting the market here in the next one actually hitting this week, Eagle Landing. That is a deal that we walked away from in the middle of last year. It's come back around to us at an even a more attractive basis. So we're picking that up again. And we've got a really awesome Core Plus deal in the Gainesville area in Georgia, which we're really, really pumped and excited about. But in conclusion, right now is a highly compelling time to really be investing, we think, in commercial real estate, and particularly within the multifamily industry with such strong fundamentals, as we outlined earlier in the presentation. We think the market bottom is in and the new growth cycle is ahead of us. Now, for those with dry powder, we think it's a prime time to be capitalizing on this current situation, particularly as those distress operators are being forced to offload their assets, where their, you know, their ability to extend and pretend completely runs out. So hopefully this presentation has given you some great starting point to consider the landscape ahead of us, you know, investing successfully, growing and protecting your capital in 2025. We think it's an incredible opportunity ahead of us. But with that being said, let's hand it over to live Q&A. Will's here. We've got, could you explain the bridge debt ideal now? When can you give an example of how you're leveraging bridge debt? Okay, so a lot of deals that are in distress have been, they've been struggling to either, you know, keep up with the vacancy or keep up with delinquency. And so for agency debt to work, you need to be 90% occupied and you need to have less, you know, a certain percent of delinquency. I think it's less than 3% for it to qualify out of the gate. Otherwise, you've got to have, you get exemptions. Some of the deals that we just flashed up to you on the screen before, the one deal that we had to walk away from last year, we wanted it to meet agency, but it just didn't. When we got into the DD, it didn't work. And so thus we couldn't pay what we thought we could pay for it. We tried to renegotiate. Now the deal's come back around to us. We know what we know. We know where the skeletons are. It's just not going to qualify for it. But with a declining interest rate environment, we can get at a very good basis and still sort of have our cake and eat it too. We can lock the interest rate with bridge debt in a deal that's, you know, really, really fantastic basis compared to the peak. And we also know where the skeletons are. So we think there's a lot of opportunities out there right now to be using bridge debt in a creative way, which is not too dissimilar to agency debt if you don't buy it down. For example, we can get in the money fixed rate debt on bridge at about 6.25%. And with agency right now, you're probably around the 6% interest rate. So without buying it down into the high fives. So they're just horses for courses right now in terms of what we're seeing and why that makes sense. So hopefully that answers your question, Will.
That's it. Now, just to add to that, you know, as operators, we're going to be in a position where it's like you either utilize bridge debt and utilize it in the smartest way possible with the best terms and shop around to a bunch of different non-bank lenders, or you don't do the deal. If you want to be buying these distressed bargains, you know, we're not going to be able to use agency debt a lot of the time. So it's, you know, it's a necessary evil, I would just add to that.
And I think that the bridge debt folks have been on the side. No one's touched it. I don't know a deal. All our deals that we've transacted in the last few years have all been agency. And then David also asks, what are some examples of credit financing? So there are, you know, there's a couple of ways out there, and I'm going to loosely talk about some of them. We've got one deal right now that the seller is going to take $1 million of seller carry financing. So in that deal, we have to raise $1 million less. Now he's going to take that on at 0% interest rate. And he just, you know, it helps get the deal done, you know. So there's just, sellers are also get out of deals and they're trying to be as creative as possible. There's also rescue capital, which is ways of where you come into certain deals where if you were to sell it today, the equity would be completely wiped out and or the debt would be wiped out to some extent. Most lenders aren't taking haircuts right now. So they're having to look for, well, how can we protect ourselves? We've got to look for another operator to come along. And there's, you know, these rescue funds that can come along, infuse capital into a deal and essentially give a hope note to the existing investors on board or currently in the deal, and a new GP will step in. A lot of that has actually been playing out. A lot of the lenders want that because if they don't have that coming along, they have to take a haircut as well. And one of the biggest things being that we have to, with extend and pretend hope notes, a lot of lenders know that they're in trouble and they're not seeing any line of sight to the finish line. Thus, the way in which they can sort of both have their cake and eat it too is bringing a new sponsor, bringing some fresh capital, maybe keep the existing equity partners around, in a, some sort of hope note form. And that has been some of the quote unquote creative ways we've seen deals getting done today.
Yeah, and I'll add to that as well. And I see a follow up from Will that I can quickly take, and then another one I want to take here. Another example of creative financing, I don't know if it necessarily qualifies, but we've got deals that have 1031 exchange investors in them that we're looking to purchase. And we're offering those 1031 exchange investors the opportunity to stay into the deal and roll over their funds again. So different ways to capitalize the deal that, help make the deal work. And then Will, how long is your bridge debt? Look, on this one deal that we're talking about that we're utilizing bridge debt, it's going to be 3 years with a 1 year extension and another 1 year extension for 5 max. So even if hypothetically we couldn't get into agency debt, we've got debt to cover us for the full length of our business plan. And then I see Sharif here has got a really good question that I want to take, and you can add color afterwards, Reid, but how can you reconcile the inevitably inflationary policies of tariffs and immigration constraint deportation with the downward sloping dot plot rate forecast? Great question. We don't have all night. But look, the first thing I'll say is that's not our dot plot. That's the Fed themselves that are predicting this. And they're trying to take into account some of these policies. And this is me totally off the cuff, but I read this stuff all the time. I follow this stuff all the time. There was a report that came out, and it was talking about how many of the people in the Federal Reserve who are coming up with this dot plot are actually factoring in their expected policy changes the Trump administration will bring, and how many are not. And there was quite a split. So there's a little bit of nuance to the way that they come up with these numbers. So, I mean, you're exactly right. Tariffs and immigration, as we've stated it, we think are going to be inflationary and cause challenges. At the same time, the economy is big and complicated. We don't really know how things are going to unfold. If we did, we'd not be in this business. We'd just be traders and making money that way. But the other thing I was going to say is that, if the Department of Government efficiency starts slashing costs like crazy, that's going to be the opposite of inflationary. It'll be deflationary. So there's a lot going on. And exactly like we've said, we want to watch this space really, really closely. And we're continuing to structure our deals in a way that even if rates don't go down, they're still going to be successful. So to wrap that up in my words, we think they're going to go down slowly, but we're not banking on that. And we're watching it really closely. Reid, anything you want to add?
I think it's a bit of a saber rattling from Trump. I just don't see how millions of Americans people are going to be deported, and that's not going to have a negative impact. And he doesn't. He doesn't like things being negative impacting his image. So I put that in the sort of unlikely bucket, maybe some tightening of the borders, but I don't think you're going to see 10 million people going home. Bias here, since I'm investing in Atlanta and neighboring markets, how are you feeling about the Atlanta and neighboring markets? Look, we feel quite bullish on that area right now. It's still a growing city. People are moving to it. It's still relatively affordable to the coastal markets. Most cities you've seen across the Sun Belt, there has been a dip in rents. Understanding of renters and evicting people has been harder. I think that's changing in real time. It's sort of enough is enough. But overall, for the long term, I believe that the Atlanta market and neighboring markets are still really, really strong offer a very compelling lower cost of living compared to coastal markets. I think that's that, Ben.
Yeah, that's a great answer. We love Atlanta, and we love the long-term prospects.
Rate and occupancy algorithm cases at Supreme Court. How are you using AI and other resources to track them and max rents daily on these larger properties? Good question, Shecky. I'll answer with smaller properties. Smaller properties, we're doing the old school gorilla. Like, you're still calling around. You're still like scraping the internet to see what the specials are that day. In terms of, I think you're referring to the real page situation. Yeah, I have, to be honest, I haven't really kept up with it. A handful of our properties are on YieldStar that can afford it. The other half of the properties are just doing, again, the guerrilla marketing. So I think in general, as my two cents is that AI is making it easier for people to become operators. Back in the day, there was a lot of ambiguity in how you could rent a property. But today, with the access to information, I can know what a two-bedroom rents for in a 5-mile radius within this, click of a fingers. That used to not be around. So I think we're in an age where a lot of tech has come to a very slow-moving industry like the commercial real estate industry. I think it's only going to have positive effects for owners to get access to real-time data, which can help us make real-time decisions. But at the end of the day, we're still operators and we still have to operate. So some things we're seeing in AI, you know, a lease AI, which is talking chatbots that can help people lease quicker. But at the end of the day, people want to still come and talk and whinge and moan and complain about things in their units to a real person, and particularly in our sort of C plus B minus workforce housing. And I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. You know, the plumbing still needs to be fixed, you know, a leaky faucet, you know, an AI is not going to be able to fix that. So AI is just another tool. And I think in general, we're in the brick and mortar business. So it's never just going to completely take over that. And so, Ben, I don't know if you have any other thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about this. You know, what a lot of people out there might not realize is that I come from a tech background and I spent the best part of a decade in big data, data science, AI. And I kind of got out of that just before AI really became a thing. But I still stay pretty close to it. And look, big picture, AI and all the data science and all the data that the world is accumulating and that people are creating products off and actionable insights, that trend is not going to change. So the feds may come after RealPage, and I don't really know about the merits of the case, but it's not going to change the dynamic. If RealPage comes down, some other group is going to come up and do something similar. This is a trend in society that there's going to be more and more actionable data to be able to make these kinds of decisions around rent and around other things. So it's not going anywhere. I see the reaction, the lawsuit as a little bit of a knee-jerky, like, look, hey, the problem that we've got in our state with rents being too damn high is this software company. It's like, no, the problem is that you don't have enough housing. The problem is there's a massive deficit of housing in the United States. That's the real problem here. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox, but, you know, that's really what I think is at play here. It's a little bit more political. At the same time, you know, we're lucky enough not to be a big enough operator that's going to be a problem for us to have a lawsuit come at us for something like that. But it is something we're watching really closely. And at the end of the day, we want to set fair rents. We want to set rents that are what the market, you know, supports, and, you know, keep our properties occupied. And, you know, that's really all I've got to say about that one.
Okay. Now, Shecky, ask you, are you looking at a fund versus single property deals? Yeah, we are entertaining a small fund moving forward. We're actually have been quizzing other operators who've done it, who successfully, unsuccessfully. You know, we haven't got the final decision, but I think in general, there is going to be some element of a fund at some point. Maybe it's opportunistic fund. Maybe it's a co-GP fund, maybe it's a pref fund. We, you know, there's a few options out there for us, but yes, we're definitely looking at some type of fund in the future. Not that every deal will be in the fund. It would just, you know, depending on the certain types of deals, because we do a lot of different deals with different partners, which can and can't allow certain funds involved. So I hope that answers that question. Do you do your due diligence to make sure that there are no unpleasant surprises with these distressed properties? Well, yeah, like that one deal we're talking about in Dallas. Yeah, we did a full lease audit, you know, walk, and that's where we found some of the problems. Not trying to get into any of the details here, but that's just part of what you have to do. And we ultimately ended up walking away from that deal at the time because we just couldn't afford to pay what we had offered. But now we're coming back to a deal like that. You know where the skeletons lie. You know how to address it because you've had your property managers, you know, come up with a plan, come up with a business plan. And, you know, the reality is that, and why, you know, we, you know, back to the question that was earlier about, you know, bridge debt, you know, part of bridge debt is understanding that these deals are in distress and it's going to take, you know, two steps backwards to take five steps forwards. So stuff like re-tenanting the property because they may have put in, you know, heads in beds, you may drop an occupancy 20% before you get back up to your 95%. That's just part of the business plan. And a bridge lender will understand that. Agency, on the other hand, they don't really want to see that type of stuff. They just want the sort of, you know, be at 90% or higher and, you know, don't bother me and just pay your bill. Where bridge debt's going to be a little bit more entrepreneurial. So, you know, in terms of the unpleasant surprises, there's always going, you're not going to know everything, but you're going to know a majority of things when you've finished a 30-day DD, and we're actually, you know, starting another 21-day DD as of tomorrow. Will, hopefully that answers that one. When these properties are upside down in value, either equity or debt has to take a hit. Yeah, that is correct. Yes. It depends on what we have. We've walked a lot of properties in the last 12 months where, you know, they bought it at 30 million, you know, the whispering 24. Guess what 24 is? 24 is a debt number, but it's coming in and it's only penciling at 22. Oh, guess what? That deal goes, you know, some deals have come out to market in the last 12 months, you know, done an active bid process to use that as ammunition to go back to the bank to say, you need to take a haircut too, or this, we need to negotiate better terms here.
You need to extend my loan.
A lot of banks have not been willing to take haircuts and thus have extended. And to Ben's graph earlier, we thought a lot of maturities were going to happen in 24. That's probably in 25 or 20 or early 26. We haven't seen many banks at all take haircuts unless you're handing back the keys and saying, yeah, good luck to you.
Yeah. And I don't want to be too sensational, but there's a lot of deals out there where equity is wiped out, and you know, there's a lot of investors, institutional, syndicated investors, and others that don't quite realize that. So there's you know, there's distress not only at the operator side but on the equity side as well. That's you know, hiding underneath the water, so to speak.
Sharif, this is a good one. Insurance, yeah, it's real. The cost of doing business in multifamily housing, it's insane. I remember back in the day when insurance was $250 a door. It's going to continue to be a problem, right? And that's going to make the margins even thinner. So I don't really have a good answer for that, besides the fact that it's going to be inflationary, and you know, that's probably going to have an impact on rents. But Ben, do you have any comments on just, you know, the state of insurance? We actually have seen insurance rates come down a little bit before this recent fire in California, but we saw the massive spike in probably 22, 23, and then it sort of come back a little bit in 2024. But Ben, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I got a lot to add, but we have limited time. But look, insurance is a mess in so many ways. You know, where to start, but I mean, it's rates are going up like crazy, but you've got insurers that are leaving, you know, states like California and Florida in droves. And it's getting to the point where people are questioning if there's going to even be an insurance provider. So a lot of the economics behind insurance don't make sense, especially when, you know, there's government actions that say, hey, you have to provide insurance, or you can't increase rates, or you can't do this. So I really don't know what the answer is to this. We're obviously watching it very closely, but insurance is, you know, it's a rapidly changing space, especially with the increase in natural disasters and weather-related events that we're seeing. So not a great answer that answers your question, Sharif, but something we're watching really, really closely.
So Jesse's here. So what are your projections on refi rates in 2 to 3 year window? 10-year treasury has been inversely related to the Fed funds rates and super volatile. We recently locked up a deal 6 weeks ago, and the treasury spiked 60 basis points since then. Appreciate your partnership. Yeah, look, Jesse, I think the treasury, the 10-year treasury today has a couple of things going on. And it sort of, there's another question further down from Brian about, hey, looking at other markets outside the US. And I'm not an expert, but, you know, I have listened to some people who are smarter than me on the economy. And the 10-year treasury, or the US bonds, seems to be, given that the US is the biggest economy in the world, the mattress for the global economy. And you're seeing a lot of money being pumped into bonds right now because places in Europe, in Japan, are offering a lot lower yields, like sub 1% or sub 2% on their treasuries. And so people, when you can get a 4.6, you know, people are flocking to the US bonds. Now, that's indicating to me that maybe there's some distress in these other markets. And, you know, does it mean that the US is immune to that distress? Surely not, right? But time will only tell. I'm not the expert on a global economy. But that is an impact in that. So I'm sort of trying to answer two questions at once. Where rates are going to go in a 2 to 3 year window, I think overall rates are going to go down. I think with a Trump presidency, there's going to be, you know, there's going to be pressure on that. And you know, to the Fed dot plot, I don't think they're going down to zero. I think that sort of 3 to 4% is probably where it stays. And you've got to look at nominal rates versus real rates. And you take, you know, where we are today, the Fed's fund rates minus, you know, where inflation is, you know, we're still in positive territory, which is, you know, having a handbrake effect on the economy, you know, it's still slowing it down. So we're in positive territory right now that will slow the economy down. and maybe they ease up on that as, you know, in the years to come. But I think interest rates will be lower than what they are today in probably 2 to 3 years' time, in a short answer. Ben, anything on that?
No. We've covered this a lot, but we appreciate the question, and any follow-ups are good. And look, I'll jump into the next one here quickly from Brian. Are you looking at markets outside the US, such as Canada, France, Germany, Spain, et cetera? I mean, we're looking at the global economy, but we're certainly not going to be investing outside of the United States. So any investment you see from RSN is going to be based on, you know, US continental soil, that's for sure. A follow-up from Will. And then that might be the last question we have. So if anyone has any follow-ups for the last 5 minutes here, anything you want to ask, now's the time. But Reid, I'll let you answer the question here from Will.
So basically, creative financing is going to make deals if debt isn't taking a haircut. Yeah, like that's correct. It's a deal by deal basis, Will. So if the creative financing or a rescue fund can come in and pay down the debt for a little bit, you know, say it's a $20 million debt, you pay it down $2, $3 million, you bring in another $2, $3 million, you wipe out the existing equity, you get to extend the deal for a period of time, you have an interest rate burden that's a lot lower. It means that the deal can last for a longer period of time, to maybe we get to some smoother sailing waters, and then you look at a refinance at that point. So there's just a lot of creative ways we are trying to do debt now trying to do deals now without the lender having to take a haircut, which is unfortunate, but it's just the way it is.
We got a couple of quick questions here. What kind of requirements do you have for your investors? Look, all of our deals are 506C, which means that you need to be an accredited investor. So you need to have an income of $200,000 per year, or $300,000 with your spouse, or you need to have a net worth of $1 million, excluding your primary residence. And there's some other ways to qualify, but they're the two most common. And beyond that, you know, just, you know, we want investors that have good working relationships with us. We know all of our investors, and that's really the only kind of requirements we have for our investors. And then what is your typical hold period and how long do you hold? We almost always write to a five-year business plan. Reid, anything you want to add to that?
No, we have abilities to exit sooner than that, but you know, real estate is a medium to long-term investment, and we always try and treat it that way.
All right. And then last question here, probably from Christopher Lifren. Reid, I'll let you take this one.
Oh, the distress is we're about to buy a 220-unit deal that's in distress. A lot of that distress is in larger properties because, you know, in the last 5 to 10 years, people have been buying bigger and bigger assets because they can syndicate easier. So the distress is in the larger stuff. So, yeah. Well, guys, want to thank you all for coming up to 4 minutes to the top of the hour. Thank you so much for this incredible for participating in today's webinar, asking some incredible questions. We are going to have this will be on our YouTube channel, and an email will go out tomorrow with all the recordings. If you do have any questions, please don't hesitate to reach out. As we also mentioned, please keep your eyes peeled for some new investment opportunities that are coming across the bow in the distress category in the next couple of weeks. And Ben, anything else you want to add to that?
No, look, it was a great session. We really appreciate everyone joining us. You know, watch your inbox for any more emails from us. And look, have a great Tuesday evening. Thank you so much.